welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 281 of the podcast, and it is the 6th of August 2016 as I record this. So today I have an interview with Jen Blood about how to write memorable characters. And Jen is my fiction editor, so it's always great to talk to her about story, and we have a really good chat. So that is coming up. In publishing news, Draft Digital has released universal links, which means you can just share one link with your readers and it will give a whole list and then will redirect to the store they use most often. And you can find that and information about it at books2read.com, books2read.com. And this is a really cool thing. I think Draft Digital are, you know, always doing very cool things. So if you go to books2read.com, you'll see it. And yeah, so that's a good start. Amazon have launched Kindle Unlimited in Japan at a sort of equivalent price to the UK and the US. So that's really interesting as well. I think Japan is one of those markets where people, you know, they are readers. They also read a lot of shorter books on mobile devices. So I'm really interested in that market. Obviously, well, I don't have any books in Japanese, but very interested in Amazon moving there. So basically they, you know, looking at where Kindle Unlimited goes and where Amazon's investing in their markets is fascinating. Japan is also where the owner of Kobo is, Rakuten. And so I'm really interested in what will happen in sort of Far East markets over the coming years. Very, very interesting to see which devices and which stores will dominate in those areas. And since we're talking about various publishers, Apple has launched an Instagram account for iBooks, which makes sense because they are highly obsessed with beautiful images. And if you want ever want a chance for merchandising on Apple, then you better have a really nice book cover. And they actually do retweet and will share beautiful images that promote books, although, you know, they can't look like anything spammy. They have to look kind of beautiful. So if you're good at images, then maybe connecting with that Instagram account for iBooks, or if you're someone with a good Instagram following. I am not. It's not a platform I've invested in at all, really. So yeah, so I think that's interesting, especially if you're into images and Instagram. But the piece of news that interests me the most this week is Forbes unveiling their list of the top earning authors in 2015. So this is the Forbes richest author list. Well, not really richest, but, you know, who made the most money in fiction. And of course, topped as ever by James Patterson, the king of putting books out fast and also, you know, really good at marketing his book shots. I've been looking at the USA Today list and I'll come back to that in a minute, but a number of his book shots are there. They are basically novellas, but he's come up with this phrase, book shots, this new word, and putting out shorter books, very fast read, which I think is great because, you know, if we can't use the word book shot because I think he's copyrighted it or, you know, done whatever he's done with it. But if readers enjoy reading novellas in genres like thriller, that really helps someone like me because I have novellas and I write in thriller. So it would be great if readers got used to that type of length. Because I've seen, you know, like Lee Child, when Lee Child's put out novellas, there's been a lot of comments about people not liking it. You know, they want a full length book. So I think it's been established in romance. But, you know, the other genres, it will be interesting. So anyway, looking at the Forbes top earning author list. Now, of course, if your definition of success is writing for the love of it, or you want to win a literary prize, then this won't be interesting for you. But if you want to make bank with your books, which I really like, that's a phrase, you want to make bank, I think it's American, then this is interesting. So you know, I write what I love to read, but I also write for long-term financial success, for sure. So it is very interesting that most of the list is made up of established genre fiction authors with a big backlist. So if we say James Patterson, Stephen King, J.K. Rowling fits, you know, in both of these categories I'm going to talk about. Danielle Steele, who, you know, I've just bought Danielle Steele's latest because, again, I'm looking at this list going, I need to learn from these authors. These are the authors who consistently please readers enough that their books instantly are bestsellers every time. And yes, traditional publishing launched them, but they satisfy. So really interesting to learn from these authors. So Danielle Steele, John Grisham, Nora Roberts, George R.R. Martin, and so brilliant to see George R.R. Martin so successful after a very long career. And at the beginning, of course, he wrote in a niche which wasn't doing so well. And now he's like king of the world. And then also on the list are Lightning Strikes, Dan Brown, E.L. James and Paula Hawkins with The Girl on a Train. Now, I call them Lightning Strikes because, you know, The Da Vinci Code, which was the book which I love, and my books, you know, are for fans of Dan Brown, really. But The Da Vinci Code, banned by the Vatican. As soon as you're banned by the Vatican, you're going to do really well. So, and of course, then they stopped banning books. So I consider the Dan Brown kind of phenomenon to be a lightning strike. It's not something you can replicate. Neither is E.L. James with 50 Shades of Grey. You can't replicate that. And you can't replicate Girl on a Train. If we could replicate it, everyone would be doing it. But those are the people I'm like, yeah, they're brilliant. I mean, you could say J.K. Rowling was a bit of a lightning strike, but it wasn't just with one book. It was with a whole series. So I think that learning from these established genre fiction authors and the kind of long-term success is commitment to putting out great books for a niche audience, so pleasing that audience again and again. That is the way to have a long-term financially successful career. Other authors on the list, YA and kids authors, Rick Riordan, Veronica Roth, John Green, who again put out consistently good books, and also Jeff Kinney with the Wimpy Kid series. So again, series authors, all of these authors, I think, are series authors, except Paula Hawkins, which it wouldn't surprise me if she dropped off the list next year, because I think that really is one of those lightning strike successes. But I find it fascinating to look at this list every year, and the same names come up again and again. James Patterson, Stephen King, J.K. Rowling, Danielle Steele, Nora Roberts. You know, these people are on the list over and over again. There is a reason. They put out books consistently. People love them. You know, and if I'm trying to read far more widely. I read a bit of a Nora Roberts book, and her writing is effortless reading. And I think that's why people love it, because the words disappear and you're left with story. And I'm pretty sure that's why they are addictive reading. But I'm definitely really investing in my craft at the moment, as I am working on the How to Write a Novel course, which it's been really great. I'm revisiting a whole load of books on craft. I'm trying to sort of codify how I work with my novels, and you know, just revisiting a lot of the aspects of story. And I feel like I've learned a lot over the last 6 to 8 years, and it will really help me with End of Days and what I'm planning on writing next. So lots of fun there. Okay, so a cool thing for you coming up. Nick Stevenson and I are doing another webinar together on automating your author marketing. And those of you who've come along to our webinars before will know we generally have a lot of fun. Nick is a funny guy, and I'm much funnier with Nick. And there might be some wine going on. And generally what we do is Nick does a great presentation with actionable tips on automating your author marketing, building your email list, and you know, generally I always learn stuff from Nick. He's a clever guy. And then we have a live Q&A, and sometimes that's half an hour, sometimes it goes on for an hour, and we have a bit of a laugh as well as giving you some great information. So if you would like to come along to the webinar, it will be Thursday 18th of August at 3 p.m. US Eastern, 8 p.m. UK. And of course, if you register, you can get the replay. You can sign up at thecreativepen.com/Nick18. So NICK18. NICK18. So thecreativepen.com/Nick18. That webinar is aimed at authors who are frustrated with their marketing, want to build their email list, or kind of just getting started with, you know, building lists and that type of thing. Okay, so that'll be fun. And of course, as ever, all the links in the show notes. So coming back to the USA Today list, which I said I've been looking at. So I saw that Mark Dawson made the USA Today list last week with the box set of his John Milson thrillers. Congratulations, Mark, who listens to the show. And I also heard Michael Lister on the Sell More Book Show a couple of weeks ago talk about his method for hitting the lists as a single author as well. Now, I've been on the USA Today and the New York Times lists in a multi-author box set a couple of years ago, which was, you know, brilliant. I'm very happy to make the list, but it's always cool to A, do it as a single author, and B, you see if it can be replicated. Now, especially as a thriller author, because, you know, as I paged through the lists, I saw Liliana Hart on there. There's a couple of other indie authors who were there, but most of them are romance. There was a romance box set as well, but thriller authors certainly struggle more to get on the list, as do other genres. So you can really see, like, by paging through, that's why I bought the Danielle Steele latest book, because the cover looks amazing and the blurb is amazing, and I was just like, okay, I can see why these books do so well. So I think analysing these lists is a really good idea. So anyway, I have a book bub this week for the Arcane Thriller Box Set, books 1-3. So that is Stone of Fire, Crypt of Bone, Ark of Blood. And if you do like the sort of Da Vinci Code style thrillers, or you like James Rollins, Steve Berry, you know, Matthew Riley, books around Daniel Silver, books like that, or if you just want three thrillers for 99 cents, and they're full length, they're not novellas, they are three full length thrillers, then you can get those on any platform this week for, and it should be all around the world, it's for sale all around the world. Of course, the USA Today list is just the US. But if you fancy trying those, then please buy it between Monday the 8th of August and Sunday the 14th of August, because the USA Today list is measured Monday to Sunday. So that would be fantastic if you fancy some summer reading. And I will report back on how that goes, because I've got a ton of other stuff booked in terms of promotions and also advertising. So it will be really interesting to see how that goes. And of course, I won't know next week. I might know the week after, because it runs in a couple of weeks later, because they get all the numbers in. Okay, so, and of course, I will blog about it, about the promotions I did and how that worked. Okay, thanks as ever for your emails and tweets. There were lots of them this week, so just picking a few. Beth says, listening to the backlist while I cycle into work along a drizzly Cowley Road in Oxford. And of course, I know the Cowley Road well from my time at Oxford University, although it's probably a bit different now. That was a while ago. Elizabeth said, while enjoying your podcast, I built this Winnie the Pooh treehouse for my granddaughter here in Seattle, which is awesome. And also wrote her first book, Amber's Atoms, to give her for Christmas, and published it on Amazon with your help. So thank you, Elizabeth. That's awesome to hear. Olga Kochagina was listening to the motivation episode with Mark McGuinness on repeat 2.5 times while putting up a shelf from IKEA, which is awesome. It's really fun to witness the development of your career backwards through the episode introductions, of course, because I've been doing these introductions for, I think, about 3 years now. I didn't do them right at the beginning, back in 2009, 2010. I didn't do introductions. But yeah, if you listen back through the backlist, you'll hear various points in my career, which is quite funny. Lots of comments about the podcast with Ellen, Ellen Bard on self-care. Meg Cowley said, love the podcast with Ellen, really resonated with me. So easy to be unkind and hard on yourself. It is true. And I think especially if you're a bit of a workaholic, like I know many people are. Cassandra Morgan, listening to the podcast while cuddling my foster kitten, and sent a really cute kitten picture. And of course, anyone can send me cute kitten pictures and puppy pictures. Kate Craik, thanks for the self-care podcast. Couldn't have come at a better time for me. And Elizabeth Barone says, the interview with Ellen, I could have listened for hours. Fantastic. Okay, so, oh, Jessie says, congratulations on passing 1 million downloads. Love the show. Brilliant. And final one, Eliza Peake says, the episode on self-care was perfect, motivated me to start my miracle morning routine again, which made me smile because I've seen these miracle morning books and I know Honoré Korda, who's been on the show and listens to the show at the gym. Hi, Honoré. You know, works with Hal Elrod on the miracle morning stuff. And what's so great is I love those books. I think they're amazing. I think everyone should aim for this. But personally, I love my sleep. There's no way I'm getting up at 5 a.m. because I think part of that miracle morning is get up early and do all this like stuff. And I'm like, I think we all have a different morning. So whatever gets you to the words. Actually, I was talking on Twitter with someone about that before, you know, the different ways that we write. So whether you're a really detailed plotter, you know, like Jeffrey Deaver writes like a 200 page outline, and so does R.L. Stine, who sold like 450 million copies of his books. Or if you're a pantser, so you just, you know, make it up as you go along, like Lee Child or Stephen King. You know, it doesn't matter how you write or when you write or, you know, however you do it. What matters is getting the words out there and the books done. So, yeah, I think we can all be quite hard on ourselves about how we should do productivity. But the fact is, if you're getting the books out there and you're meeting your goals, then good on you. All right. So thanks as ever for your comments and tweets. I always love to get them. And you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or email me joanna@thecreativepen.com. And I love the interaction we have. And I really appreciate you all getting in touch. Okay, so today's episode is sponsored by 99 Designs, and you can get a power pack upgrade worth $99, which gives your project more chance of getting noticed by going to 99designs.com/Joanna, J-O-A-N-N-A. So on 99 Designs, you can get all kinds of designs for your author business, including book covers, merchandising, branding, business cards, illustrations, artwork, and much more. So how does it work? Well, you decide on your project and write a detailed description and then post it for all the designers to see. For example, an ebook cover or a print cover, a Facebook ad image, a custom header for your website, custom illustration, which I did for the map of Aotearoa, New Zealand, in the front of dark fantasy novel Risen Gods, and also the key to the gates of hell. And at this stage, definitely add detail. So genre, you know, dark fantasy versus romance will result in different colour schemes, different fonts, that type of thing. Also include examples of covers or images that you like that will give the designers some hints. Then you'll start getting designs in, and that can be exciting, and also you'll be like, whoa, that is not what I meant, which is why being very specific in your, well, not specific as in, you know, telling people exactly what to design, but be specific around genre. So if you wanted something dark fantasy, say that, and then you won't get a pink design. So the designs will come in, you can add comments and feedback and stars, and the designers might come back with another round, other iterations. You can also do a poll to your audience, which is really fun. Although what I would say is, the other thing, you know, in general, I was thinking about this with book cover designs, because I also this week got a new cover for One Day in New York, which is a thriller novella set in New York. And I realized that one of the very key points is the fact that it has a theme of angels. And I won't give away a lot of it, but yeah, angels are really important. And the book cover didn't have angels on. And I recently, I think I've talked about it, but I read the Susan E. Penryn series, which has angels. And of course, I really like Lainey Taylor's series. And, you know, angels is a subcategory on Amazon. So I was like, okay, I should really put an angel on the cover. So I have a new cover for One Day in New York. You can have a look at that. It's really awesome. I love it. And now has an angel on, but in a very thriller way, a thriller angel, dark thriller angel. So anyway, I really like that. So the point is, you may change your cover later, or you'll get loads of different variations of it. Anyway, you only pay on 99designs if you're happy, and it is a super fun process, and you can get a lot of cool designs that way. You can get a power pack upgrade worth $99, which gives your project more chance of getting noticed by going to 99designs.com/Joanna, J-O-A-N-N-A. So this corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a massive thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. And, you know, I'm really, it continues to make me so grateful that you guys like the show enough to support me, even just, you know, $2 a month, or some of you, you know, being very generous and giving more than that. So thanks as to everyone supporting on Patreon, and especially to new patrons: Courtney Novak, Nicholas Kotar, Claire Sager, Brittany Fichter, and Greg Fasikas. I want to say Fasikas. I hope that's right, Greg. Or Fazikas. Anyway, Greg. Thanks, Greg. And thank you everyone for supporting the show and for buying my books and courses and everything. And I'm brilliant. And I hope that we can all continue doing this for years. I'm feeling very grateful at the moment in general for being able to do this life. And you guys are part of it. So I really want to continue being useful to the community. And I'm so pleased you enjoy the show. So if you would like to support on Patreon, it will, you know, can be less than a coffee a month or a couple of coffees a month. And now you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio, which I will be recording in the next 2 weeks, I think. So you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. So thank you. And here's the interview. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm here with Jen Blas. Hi Jen.
Hi Joanne.
It's great to have you back on the show. Just a little introduction. Jen is the author of the best-selling Erin Solomon Mysteries and a phenomenal editor at adianediting.com, and Jen is my editor, so we're always happy to talk to her. And her first non-fiction book, The 5-Day Fiction Fix, Creating Complex Characters, is out now, and that's what we're talking about today. You've been busy.
I've been very busy. Yes, absolutely. But in a good way. It's all stuff that I love, and it's really actually very exciting to move into the nonfiction. That's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's a really good point. We might have time to come back to that, but I have so many questions on this. So what I wanted to start with is, you know, obviously you're an editor, you're an author, you see this whole thing from every perspective. Why choose to start with a book on character out of all the things you could have picked on writing? Why is it so important to start with character?
Well, it's a really good question, actually. But I think that fundamentally, that's what kind of draws people into a story, is as people, we want to make that human connection. And once you make that connection, then that you've gone a very long way in actually selling your story, if you can make a human connection with your readers. And so I really think that character is kind of the foundation of what makes a good story. So it seemed like the best place to kind of start.
Yeah, and it's funny, I was thinking about it too. And also, you're a dog lover, aren't you?
Sure.
Yeah, and I was thinking about how, you know, because many people actually care more about animals than they often do about humans. Is, you know, the word character doesn't necessarily just mean human, does it? What are the other types of characters that we'll be, you know, be looking at?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I really do think that it can be anything. I mean, you look at like Tom Robbins did, like all of these sort of weird fiction that I used to love in my late teens and early 20s. That was, you know, featured. I think one of them was like one of the characters was a soup can, and just all of this sort of bizarre stuff. But yeah, and I'm working on a series now that's about search and rescue dogs, and certainly there are human characters in there, but the dogs also have a lot of character as well. So yeah, it's really whatever you choose to focus on, whatever the person, object, whatever, you have to have those characteristics that draw people in.
Okay, so being more practical, how do we make people care about the character, especially in a world with Kindle downloads where you've only got a couple of pages where people make a decision whether to read or not? So what are the different types of ways we can make people care about our characters?
Well, I think the biggest thing is, and it's actually a lot harder to make people care about the characters in the first couple of pages. It's almost like you have to have a good sense of who the character is and sort of demonstrate through action who that character is and what they're doing. So there's, I think you'd use the example at one point of the save the cat moment. It's that thing where there's an active, demonstrable way that your character is interacting with the world around them, in a way where people are going to say, oh, wow, all right, this is somebody that I want to learn more about. So you don't start the story off with necessarily. I know that there are some famous books that have done that, but I'm not a big fan. you don't start off with when I was five and da-da-da and this happened and blah, blah, blah. But again, I know some people do. In action or plot-driven fiction, that's not typically the best way to go about things. But if you can start with an action moment, but then have the character interacting in the world in a way that is going to make people stand up and take notice, that's really a great way to kind of draw them in. And then from there, then you can develop the character and show some other ways that they interact with the world and change and grow or whatever over time.
Yeah. So, for example, we don't start with Jen got up and brushed her teeth. We start with, Jen in a snowstorm rescuing a dog that's fallen down a cave or something.
Sure.
Yeah. I can see you doing that. And that demonstrates character through action. And that also, I was thinking about this, because your books spark lots of things for me. It also works with the show, don't tell, right? We don't say opening chapter, Jen is a dog lover. We say, we show Jen rescuing the dog in the storm.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what are some other things around the show, don't tell around character?
I think that it really is, some of the other stuff is bringing in secondary characters and the way that they interact with those characters. It's about dialogue. It really is always about action. And so there's a limited amount, I think, of backstory that people actually need to know. Over the course of the story, and it really is bringing in those active moments. And again, it's the interaction, it's how people are in the world. And I always bring it back to sort of being organic with your story and thinking about the way that we actually view the world in real life. So when we are getting to know someone, we're not privy to their thoughts. We don't hear their inner dialogue. Mm-hmm. The way that we get to know someone in actual life is by what they do and the things that they say and the things that they do and the way that they behave. So kind of applying that to the story, I think is really the best way to ensure that your readers are having that organic experience that echoes life, but in obviously a much more exciting way a lot of the time.
And that kind of feeds into the different faces that we put on, so if you meet a character, with their mother, they're going to behave differently than, if they're with their husband or wife.
Right.
Or with a best friend. Or me on screen now, you and me now on screen in a professional, way. This is a different us than it would be, over some drinks if we were best mates downtown type of thing.
Right.
So is that, can you do that through the interactions with the secondary characters, like you said?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that really is. That really demonstrates that the author genuinely knows who this character is, if they can gauge how the character is going to relate to people depending on their station in life and the relationship between them and everything else. And I think that ultimately is exactly how we really get to know these characters is by watching that play out.
Mm. And then I guess, you know, a question for you as an author and an editor, how do you prepare to write with your characters? Like, I know some people have this sort of, you should know what their parents did for a living, and you should know like what their political party they are, and you should know all this stuff about what school they went to and blah, blah, blah. Or do you kind of do more discovery writing?
I actually am a big fan just because I love characters so much. So it's very fun for me. That's kind of how I get into the story initially. Even though I write plot-driven fiction, it's for plot-driven fiction, I think it's pretty character-centric. Mm-hmm. And so I love that first getting to know the characters. And so I usually do a lot of work up front. And then as I'm going along, sometimes I'll feel like I'm losing my way. And a lot of times it's because I don't understand where the character is coming from. And so I find that a lot of times if I can go back and kind of look at the character and figure out what's going on with them, then that helps me moving forward. So for me personally, it's I do a lot of work. I want to know everything about them. But then it's drawing that line, because readers don't need to know, and they don't want to know everything about who your character is and what they did when they were five and how they felt at seven when their fish died. So... So it's kind of it's figuring out how to walk that line so that you know. And a lot of times the author knowing that information kind of informs the narrative so that you get that sense, and you and the reader really understands where the character is coming from. But you as the author don't need to spell all of that out for them.
Mm. And I guess I'm more of a just-in-time writer, you know, certainly more than you are. I was thinking like Morgan Sierra and Jake, you know, what we've seen Morgan's house in Crypt of Bone, for example. We go to Morgan's house, but I don't, and I know where Morgan lives. I've been to that street, like, you know, I have that in my head. She's my main character, that's right. But Jake, who's the main secondary character, as you know, obviously is my editor, but for people listening, Jake... I don't know where he lives, and like I still don't know where he lives, and I don't think it's important. Like, what's important is that he was in the military, he's South African, you know, there's things about him that are important, but to me, where he lives or what his home life is like doesn't really matter. So is that all, you know, that's acceptable, isn't it? You only need to know for the story.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's totally about style. And I think it's, I think as with so much of writing, I'm always reluctant to say this is the way that you have to do it. And there's only one right way. And if you don't do it this way, then you're a failure and you're going to die alone. So that's bad. it's whatever works for you.
Yeah, exactly. So there is no right way. Now, I wanted to ask about tips for describing a character, so their physical aspects, that don't involve mirrors.
Oh, yeah, that's really hard. It's very hard. I mean, especially if it's first person, then it's virtually impossible to...
First person point of view. For people listening, so if you write in a first person point of view, you kind of have to look in a mirror.
Right, yes. It's hard for... Yeah, it's... but, I mean, it really is... you don't... I think that the key is kind of finding a couple of distinctive things and kind of relating them with respect to what's going on around. So, for example, my character Erin Solomon is short. She's 5'2", and she's a redhead. And so it's very easy to get that in there because, you know, she's always talking to people who are taller than her. It's very easy to, you know, over the course of a scene, have that kind of perspective come in there. So she'll say something disparaging about the fact that, you know, she doesn't even reach his shoulder or whatever. And so I think that we don't really need to know every aspect of what these characters look like. It's a sketch. And so if you can find a couple of trademark things, and so like Morgan's eyes or something, I always think of, she's got those, you know, those eyes.
Yeah.
And so you kind of work with those trademarks, and readers are going to fill in the blanks. They don't need to know exactly the measurements and everything else. So
I wonder if that's a genre thing as well, though, because, you know, I don't write chick lit. I have read some, and certainly some, you know, if there's a much more about fashion, for example, some authors might describe a lot more about what people are wearing in terms of labels, because that's the type of genre. Whereas you and I writing thrillers, often the type of gun or getaway car it might be more appropriate. You know, I certainly never really think about what people are wearing unless it's important for the plot. So Morgan and Jake go to Iran, and Morgan does wear the chador and keeps her weapons under it.
Yeah, sure, exactly. Yeah, I do. I think that it definitely, there are different conventions with all of the different genres. And so absolutely, and they're certainly in like romance, they're much more interested in exactly the physical, you know, what they look like and what the guy looks like and what color his eyes are and what color his hair is and how it waves or whatever.
We're clearly not writing the right genre for that. But I think, you know, especially with erotica, for example, I think, you know, describing that physicality is probably more important.
Yeah.
You know, than that. Okay, so let's talk about character arc. So first of all, what is a character arc and how can you do it for, say, a standalone or a series?
Well, I think that people have kind of a misconception about character arc, where they there's actually one of the most common definitions is that there's a marked change, and I think that like the diction or the Wikipedia definition is like they become a different sort of person by the end of the novel, which I don't agree with. I think that if you look at a lot of novels, the characters don't become a different sort of person by the end of the novel. They become, there may be a deepening of their experience or their understanding, but to me, character arc is simply the inner journey that the character experiences over the course of the novel. And so that kind of opens things up a lot, because I think certainly in, especially in genre fiction, you don't see this drastic change in these long-term series where the character starts out one way and then by the end has this big revelation and changes his life and whatever. But I think it's all about understanding where your character is coming from and allowing for that experience to deepen over time. And so, for example, in the Aaron Solomon series, Aaron starts out as someone who's very obsessed with this particular mystery that she's bent on solving at all costs. And over the course of the five novels, she ultimately comes to a place where that is still a key aspect of her life, but she's more concerned with the others around her, and she's she's ultimately, there are times when she walks away from it to save the people that she loves and that sort of thing. So it's that kind of evolution over time and kind of shift over time. But then you can have things like Lee Child's Jack Reacher novels, where Jack Reacher kind of starts off as a loner who is willingly chosen this life of drifting and crime solving and all of that. And he kind of, at the end of every novel, kind of makes a conscious choice to remain that. And so he's kind of making that conscious choice not to change, not to make that big shift.
But, yeah. And again, that his books are a kind of Lone Ranger style.
Yeah.
A model. And yeah, I guess it's slightly, and similarly, your Aaron Solomon Pentalogy, five books, has an arc, whereas I feel like my Arcane series is more episodic in terms of, you know, like solve a mystery within, and then the mystery solved, and then there's another mystery, and, you know, it kind of works more like that. So I think it's great that you say that you don't believe it should be that change. I think that must come from screenwriting or from literary fiction, for example.
Yeah. I think so. So, but your characters definitely, I mean, like, you look at the journey that Jake has been on over the years and stuff, and the journey that Morgan's been on. I think they definitely have a fairly profound inner journey that they go on over time.
I guess when you've got one book, when it's a standalone, you kind of have to force that much more. Like Risen Gods, my dark fantasy one, there is much more of a, you know, a change, and you have to change because you have to save the world type of thing.
Right. Yeah. Yep.
Over the course of time. So let's get to character motivation, because as part of my research for my next book, End of Days, I thought I would watch the Arnie movie End of Days. Oh. And I don't know if people remember this, because it came out in like the late 90s for the millennium type of thing. And there were some really awful motivations for some of the actions that went on. And I was just sitting there going, what? Why do that? Like, that's ridiculous. So when it comes to what a character wants, which is a very important part of a plot, and motivation, how can we make things realistic in terms of character?
I think, again, it's going back to, and it's hard because most of us aren't in a situation where we have to choose things like saving the world or, you know, and so it's hard to imagine us necessarily being motivated to do the things that our characters do a lot of the time. But I think that ultimately it is about kind of, I used to act when I was in high school, and I was all about like method acting and all of this stuff. And I read Stanislavski when I was 15, and I was like, this is what I want to do, and da-da-da, and I'm going to sit in a bathtub of ice and whatever. but I always think of sort of method writing instead of method acting, where you kind of get inside your character's skin. You start really thinking about, okay, what possibly could motivate them to need to do whatever it is that they need to do, whether it's save the world or solve the mystery or, you know, all, whatever it is. And I think that it's a lot of that. And then it's also about recognizing that the more detailed you get, the more convoluted it's going to sound. And so if you can give like a basic sketch of who the character is without completely going into, I don't know.
Well, I think it's interesting. Like, one of the stronger things about The End of Days, and I think it's a common thing we all use, is that, you know, his family is the thing that drives his emotion.
Right.
And the same, you know, in both of our books, when there's family involved or a child, something threatens a child, you know, your own children or another child's, the children in Jeopardy thing, or your dog, you know, like some readers will not read a book where an animal is harmed, but they don't care how many people you kill, right?
Right.
So I think if you tap into what people care about, that can be the reason, like that is the main reason, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. And I think you're right. I think that's exactly right, is that you have to, once you do that, then, and your readers can empathize with that, because they certainly are in the same boat. You know, if they're most people, if their family is in danger, then they'll do anything. And that's also a great way to get your readers to care about your characters.
Yes.
Is when they go out on a limb to save their family or to save whoever they care about.
So I think, and there I was also sort of thinking about the bigger issue of theme and the big backgrounds that people have. And I don't even know how I got to it, but I've just downloaded Sophie's Choice by William Styron, which of course is about Nazi Germany and a woman's choice. At a very specific level, I don't think it's a spoiler to say between her children, you know, not in the situation that they're in, but you know, that, so you don't write a book about the Nazis and evil, the evil of that. You write a book specifically about one woman and her children, which brings everything down to the level of character.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that's the way that that to me is the most compelling way to tell any story, is to bring it to the level of, you know, these individual characters. And so, you know, whether it's The Mists of Avalon or, you know, any of these books where otherwise you don't necessarily, or Clan of the Cave Bear or something, where you don't necessarily expect to love the setting or the time period or whatever, but you fall so in love with the characters, and then you learn all of these things and become completely drawn into this world that the author has pulled you into. But it really is through the lens of the character.
Oh my goodness, you've now, in my head, I've got John Dillard, was he the Neanderthal? Was he the Homo sapiens? I can't remember, but he was the love interest, right?
Right, yeah.
I'm like, oh my God, I must have been about 15 when the Clan of the Cave Bear.
I know, I was actually talking to my aunt this morning. We were talking about character and stuff, and that's got what got in my head. And I know, I think I was 16 or 17 when I read it, so.
Well, it's interesting because I've also been, you know, I know one of my, and we all have superpowers as writers, and we all have weak points.
Sure.
And you know, I think setting for me is a superpower. I'm pretty good at setting, you know, because I've been to a lot of places and I love setting. But I'm not very good at emotion, and so I've been trying to really think about how to make my writing more emotional, and that has to do with character, doesn't it? So what do you think in terms of how do you make your writing more emotional around character?
Oh, it's so hard because it's so easy to overdo. Yeah. I really think that, it really takes kind of a light stroke because, I also think it, again, it depends on genre and it depends on audience. Because for your books, if you went too deeply into the emotion, then I think that you would lose a lot of readers. Certainly for the Arcane series, if suddenly, you know,
everyone's crying.
Yes,
no explosions.
Yeah. And I think it really is about, it all comes back to being true to the character and understanding. So if your character isn't an emotional character, then it's really hard to infuse the writing with emotion unless you put them in heightened circumstances with people who are more emotional or who trigger them in some way. Mm. So if Morgan, for example, in your books is in a situation where she is with family, or there's something along those lines, then she's going to be more emotional. There's going to be more at stake there. Whereas with Twilight, for example, and the audience that you have there and the vampires and Bella and whoever they are. I have read it, the first one, but it wouldn't make sense for her to be unemotional and all of that. So I think that you really, the first step is understanding who you're writing for and who your character is. And then I think a lot of times the emotion kind of flows from that. So,
yeah. Well, I've been thinking a lot about longevity as an author and writing in different genres, and also that you know, if you want, there are lots of very, you know, we're at this point in the indie world where people are prolific. People are writing lots of books. And I look at, you know, prolific writers like Enid Blyton, for example, Agatha Christie, you know, some of these people who've written hundreds of books, Nora Roberts, even Stephen King to a point, you know, to a point. It's they, there are, you know, Stephen King, who I love, and you like his books too, right?
If
you
say,
okay, so Stephen King's written 45 books, name them. And you won't be able to. You'll be able to name a couple of, you know, which ones come to your mind.
Right. Yeah. And so like The Shining.
The Shining. And, okay. So The Shining and, also would be a top one for me, and The Stand and It. I was looking at It again, actually, because it's so, so big, but also, you know, it's kind of told in flashback and it's a group of friends. And I was trying to think, why is this book so memorable? And it's not actually because of the evil clown. It's because of the friends who tackle evil together. So this group of friends, and Stephen King is so memorable, I think, because of his characters.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Because he writes some pretty bad endings. I mean, even It is not, you know, when the monster is revealed, it's not that big a deal. But what's interesting is that the relationships between the friends. So is the heightening of emotion just the deepening the character in the world, I guess?
Yeah, I think that it definitely is. I do think that... yeah, and I think for me, because when I hear when I think emotion, I immediately go to that like emotional sort of amplified place, and I'm from New England, and we don't like that sort of thing.
Yeah, I'm English. So we don't do that either.
Yeah, and so, but yeah, I think that it is. It's about the character resonating and being authentic and being sort of a profound, like a character that has a rich inner life, and the reader kind of tapping into that. Mm. And so I think that that's it as much as anything, really.
Yeah, or kind of that revelation of a truth. The other, the weepy, the one that gets me is The Notebook by Nicholas Sparks.
Oh, sure, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's a killer. That one really is, isn't it? So, you know, these it emotional is, truths. Always,
oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and there, I mean, there are definitely, there are authors who do it so well. And, yeah, it's getting to that emotional truth, and it's when you can do that and tap into something that is going to resonate with readers, then that ultimately is what the emotion is all about. And I think the other thing about emotion is that for me, I always think of it as, I can't remember who said it to me, but when it's almost like when the character is crying, then it doesn't allow for the reader to cry. It's, and so if the character is so overwrought and lost in the emotion, then the reader, it strikes that chord where they're not okay with experiencing their own emotions because they're too concerned about the character who's out of control. Mm. And so if you can do those emotions in a way where you are kind of letting the reader almost experience those emotions for the character in a way, then I think a lot of times that's more powerful than if your character is breaking down and sobbing.
Mm. And that's also back to the show don't tell, in that, you know, it's not like I'm really angry and I want to save my daughter.
Yeah, exactly.
Which I was doing a screenwriting thing, and it was like, that's what they call on the nose dialogue.
Yeah.
I am angry. No, you never write, I am angry.
Right,
have to show their anger. No, I think that's right. Okay, so coming back to some other questions. Let's talk about, protagonist, antagonist. So can you just kind of define what those are?
Sure. Well, the protagonist is the typically the central character. They usually have some kind of positive motivation or a goal that is admirable in some way. The antagonist is typically the central character who is stands in the way of the protagonist achieving his or her goal. So that is that's it in a nutshell. Between the two.
Yeah, and so what do people get wrong with these two, as in you know, because then people go, oh, but you know, what about Dexter, or what about, you know, these or in House of Cards, you know, Frank Underwood, these kind of anti-heroes or negative protagonists versus, you know, a good antagonist. So are they good and bad, you know, are there rules in other ways?
Yeah, you know, what's really interesting is that I just read an article about sort of the rise of prequels and the way that they, in those prequels, they, like, for example, in Star Wars, the prequels, and they describe how Darth Vader became the horrible baddie that he is. And it talks about the fact that it kind of defeats the purpose, because it, you get to know the character so much in those prequels, and then he's a bad guy. And so no matter whatever it is that happened to those, it happened to them in those early years, there's not really anything that can explain how they then became crazed mass murderer kind of people. And so it just, the author was talking about the fact that a lot of times it's better to leave that motivation murky for an antagonist. So you look at people like Dexter, who in a different narrative would definitely be a bad guy, but we understand his motivation. We understand, and you know, even though his sort of thinking is a little skewed with the, you know, murdering the bad guys in really heinous ways,
but we still root for him. So he's still the protagonist. Is it that the protagonist is just the main person that we're following in the story?
Yeah, and we do have a better understanding of where they're coming from. And so I think that a lot of times, if you go with an antagonist, it's good to understand. It's good to understand who they are. It's good to it's good to have develop some quirks and develop that character. But if you go too far into the realm of motivation and backstory, then a lot of times it kind of pulls the plug on just how effective they are as villains. So like Hannibal Lecter, you know, you look at kind of
the other books didn't really work, did they?
Yeah. And, but you look at, you know, the quintessential Silence of the Lambs and everything. And he is the villain. Or you look at Othello and Iago and Othello. And that's been a debate for, you know, centuries as to what Iago's motivation actually was. And so I think with protagonists, you really need to understand who they are. You need to understand where they're coming from, what they want, and why they want it. With antagonists, if you can create a compelling psychological profile and create that rich character through that, and make it clear what it is that they want, then I think a lot of times that's actually enough to make a really phenomenal antagonist.
That's good. I'm glad you say that, because I really like doing I need to have an explanation for the bad guy, and I like it to be quite good. But I must say, you know, with End of Days, it's kind of obvious what they want.
Yeah, sure.
And someone has to stop it. But that's, you know, big thriller type motivation. So whereas, you know, and I was thinking also that the antagonist, again, doesn't have to be human. You know, often a monster like an it, you know, it is a
right.
monster, alien monster, although there's other antagonist characters along the way, or nature, right? There can be a man mm-hmm. against nature story.
Sure. Yeah.
The antagonist can be the world. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that type of thing. Okay, so I know we're running long, but very exciting topic. What about other characters? So, you know, some places, for example, I like to read, I really like the Jonathan Maybury, Joe Ledger series, which has got like a team. And mm-hmm. I see the benefit of having a team of characters who you return to. And Arcane's a very small team. And I feel like if I was doing it again, which I may obviously do, I would design a bigger team because then there's more possibilities. You have quite a lot of secondary characters mm-hmm. in Erin Solomon. So what are the secondary characters there for? And what are the types of secondary characters?
Well, the secondary characters are essentially sort of, if you're thinking of it in like movie terms, they're the supporting cast. And so they help to develop your main character. They certainly help to develop the plot and keep things moving. And but I think that the key to secondary characters is really actually knowing who they are. And allowing them to have goals and motives themselves over the course of a story. And so certainly in the Erin Solomon series, there's Erin's mom is in there and she's got her own baggage and it's huge. there, you know, the love interests in there are just this whole, basically by the end, there are a team of people who are working together. But it does, I mean, it also provides a subplot sometimes so that your main character doesn't have to be, if your main character isn't in a particular chapter or whatever, if you can have a compelling subplot with secondary characters, then that's one more reason for readers to keep coming back to hear about, you know, who these people are. And for me, I mean, a lot of times the secondary characters kind of take on a life of their own. So the new series that I'm working on is a spinoff of the Erin Solomon series with a search and rescue dog handler. And it just felt like there was more to that character that I hadn't explored yet. So I think that it's really, and it also gives us, it's going back to that show versus tell thing where you are showing your readers exactly how your character interacts with the world. So if you have someone who's not terribly likable, but they're hilarious with their best friend, their best friend comes in, that's automatically a way that you can start to kind of empathize with the character and find something that's redeemable about them, or they're, you know, phenomenal with their niece or their dog or whatever. So yeah, I think that secondary characters are just, they make a narrative so much richer.
And just from a purely technical perspective, if one person is alone in a setting, your writing will just be blocks of text as narrative an internal thought, because there's no dialogue. You can't, unless you're talking to yourself, which isn't dialogue. Right. So purely from a technical point of view, you have to populate the world.
Yes.
With these characters. So so that is something to think about. And what do you think about the kind of archetypes? You know, for example, I have Ben, who's like Father Ben, who's a sort of mentor figure, sort of, you know, Yoda, Obi-Wan type of figure. And I didn't really think about it when I was writing that first book. Do you think these archetype characters just emerge anyway?
I think,
or should
they
we design them?
You know, I think that they do. I think that it's, I certainly don't go into a novel saying this is going to be this thing and it's going to serve this role and da da da.
Some people don't they?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, certainly there are people who are more analytical about it and who do that. And that's fine if they want to do that. But I don't think that it's necessary for you to assign those roles when you start and say this person's going to serve this particular role. But I do think it's interesting that ultimately they do sort of, it does boil down to them kind of falling into those archetypes. I think that's always kind of an interesting thing.
Mm. And we should also say, like, and this is not a marketing podcast today, but what you're doing with the spin-off characters will drive people who've read the Erin Solomon series and enjoyed it will likely carry on to a new series that features the same character.
Yeah, no, I think that that's definitely that's a big plus. So I was watching it. I don't remember if it was an interview with you or someone else, but it was something CJ Lyons said at some point where she was talking about just the fact that if she could start over again, what she would do from the start is
link them all together.
Yes, link them all.
And the romance authors are the people who do this amazingly well. Like, they'll come up with a family, or Marie Force has this Gansett Island, or, you know, Bella Andre has these families. So they have a lot of siblings, and then there's the cousins, and then, you know, so you can just have an event like a wedding and a whole load of people turn up, and then you can follow these people. And someone says, why don't you do that with thrillers? And I'm like, yeah, but everybody dies. but that does come back to the team thing, I guess. And actually, this is what I'm planning for the next three kind of things that I'm going to do. They will spin off. And I did link two of my series together with Day of the Vikings. I have Blake and Morgan. So I think that's a big tip to people, is use your secondary characters in spin-off stuff, especially if they're interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
You know.
Yeah, it's a great source.
Fantastic. Right. We're so almost out of time, but we'll do one more question.
Okay.
So you see so much as an editor. So what are the biggest things that people get wrong about character?
You know, it's funny. You would think that it would be that they didn't develop the character enough, but I think character development is almost innate for writers a lot of the time, where that's kind of where they start, because writing is a really technical thing, and so it's hard to figure out all of the technical aspects, but anybody can write a character profile or can start with one. And so what I find is that writers will come in and they'll know so much about their character, and they're so enthusiastic about who that character is, that they just dump everything in the first chapter. And so I think that's really the thing that I see time and again, where people are just, they may start out perfectly with, you know, this big, great action sequence, and then it just stops in the second page, and suddenly we're in a flashback to when they were five and they stepped on a butterfly and everything changed. And so it's really, I think that's the biggest thing. And so it comes down to really asking yourself how much the reader really needs to know to be drawn into the story, and then trusting that if you give them a little bit and spread it over time, that's going to be so much more effective than trying to give them all of the backstory in that first chapter, first couple of chapters.
Mm, absolutely. That's fantastic. Okay. So your book is The 5-Day Fiction Fix, Creating Complex Characters. So where can people find your book and your Erin Solomon series and your everything else?
Okay. Well, they can find the book on pretty much all of the online outlets. So Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Kobo and Apple and all of them. It's there. And then they can find out about Erin Solomon and my fiction at jenblood.com. And my nonfiction, they can find out that as well. And all of my mysteries are available on all of the outlets as well. And my editing business and some of my nonfiction, and also an editing sheet and all kinds of stuff, you can find at adianediting.com.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for your time, Jen. That was great.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. if you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.